by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh on Tuesday, May 10th at 5 p.m. in Folinger Auditorium on the south end of the U of I Quad. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. On this program, this first hour of the program, we will return to a subject that we have talked about many times before, and that is the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. We have tried to have guests on the program to represent different perspectives, particularly when there has been someone here in Champaign-Urbana that has been brought here to speak. And we've tried to take advantage of those opportunities when we can, and we are doing that here this morning as we talk with Palestinian-American political activist Mazen Kumsia. In a book that he's authored titled Sharing the Land of Canaan, he writes that there is no more compelling story with more international ramifications than this conflict, that between Israel and the Palestinians. He says that it is a conflict that often has been reduced to simple statements about religion and violence, and that some people have concluded that it was something that simply cannot be solved. He certainly disagrees with that. He argues there is a way forward, and we'll get some of his thoughts this morning on the program. Let me tell you just a little bit about him. He was born and raised on the outskirts of Bethlehem, was educated both in the Middle East and the United States. He has a master's degree from University of Connecticut and a PhD from Texas Tech University. Also did postdoctoral training at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and the University of Tennessee. And he is, by his scientific training, a geneticist. He also, though, for perhaps the past 15 years or so, has been involved in political issues and has done a lot of speaking and writing. He has published many op-ed pieces and has appeared in various national publications like the Washington Post and the New York Times, has been interviewed on CNBC and C-SPAN. He's also published many scientific papers in areas ranging from zoology to genetics. And as I mentioned, is the author of the book Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, and it is published by Pluto Press, so you can look for that book. And the questions here on the program are welcome, as always. If you'd like to call in, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. Good anywhere that you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455. So people are certainly welcome to call. The only thing we ask of callers is that people try to be brief, and we ask that so we can get in as many as possible and keep things moving along. And I also, at our guest here this morning, will be giving a couple talks here in the area in Champaign-Urbana, and a little bit later on the program, I'll give you the information. So if you would like to go and hear from him, you can do that. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you very much for having me, David.
As I mentioned, your academic training is in science, and you worked as a scientist and are still, I believe, at Yale.
No, actually, I'm no longer at Yale. I have a private lab that we're running testing on.
All right. Well, formerly has been at has taught at Yale. And in the book here, I think that you mentioned that maybe that you've only really been intensely involved, politically involved, maybe for about 15 years or so. What was it that led you, at the point that you did, to want to be involved in this issue politically?
Right. In 1988 and 89, there was a Palestinian uprising, and my town, Beit Sahur, which is a shepherd's field where the shepherd saw the star, went up to Bethlehem, was engaged in a tax revolt, a nonviolent resistance to the Israeli occupation. And I was in the U.S. at that time, and the media here, as they are still today, they express basically, they show issues only when there's violence. And they chose not to show the nonviolent resistance of this town, a biblical town, basically. And the media was rather silent on this issue. And the Israeli army had come with 44 tanks, surrounded the town, and then sent in over 120 trucks, which basically pillaged the town of everything valuable, including cars and TVs and so forth. And the media here was silent. And that got me very interested in speaking to the media and talking about these issues publicly in the U.S., which before that time I was not very actively involved in. Mm.
Well, that raises a question, because I think that often the criticism of the Palestinian movement is made, and admittedly this is painting with a very broad brush, that they have used violent methods. And people have raised this question, why is there not some sort of a more nonviolent civil disobedience kind of right. of movement? From time to time, we've talked about here in this program, and sometimes people have said, well, they just think that there is no such tradition in the Middle East. Can you talk about that? Is there, in fact, a lot of nonviolent political action
yes.
going on?
Like all anti-colonial, anti-settler activities, whether it's in South Africa or whether it's the Native Americans here, the majority of violence in all these situations are nonviolence. Also in Palestine, the majority of resistance is nonviolent. Of course, the oppressors, the colonial people, always want to emphasize the tail of the curve of resistance, which is always a bell-shaped curve, the tail that is violent and also the tail that's extremely violent and that affects civilians. In Native Americans versus white European settlers, there were massacres on both sides. But what we heard about is not the nonviolent resistance of the Native Americans, but what we heard about is how the Native Americans are savages, how they attacked those white, beautiful settlers. And that's what the settlers would like always to show the world, basically. And in South Africa, the same thing. The apartheid regime in South Africa was more interested in showing the world the necklacing, putting rubber tires around people, burning them alive. That's the image that they want the world to see. And that's the image that's presented in the U.S. media, unfortunately. It is not showing the much larger 99.999% of the resistance that's nonviolent, which is ignored in the media here. As I said, with my own story with my town of Beit Sahur just over 15, 16 years ago.
Are there particular cases where you would point to nonviolent political action that you thought was actually particularly effective and, again, perhaps hasn't gotten a lot of attention?
Well, you know, the nonviolent action works when the media covers it. And the media in the U.S. has not covered it. The media in Europe has covered it, and that's why the public in Europe has changed in its perceptions of the Middle East. And I think that's where I see some effect of nonviolent resistance. For example, about the wall, there has been a lot of nonviolent resistance to the wall. There has been a lot of coverage in European media about that, just like there's coverage of nonviolent resistance in South Africa, which changed a lot of the perceptions of people in Europe. And that's why the European countries are much more open to the reality of what's going on the ground than many in the U.S. media.
Mm-hmm. I think also in the minds of a lot of people, it's perhaps not just enough that there be a nonviolent component to the Palestinian movement, but also that there be a more vocal condemnation of violence. What do you say about that?
Well, I mean, in general, what you see, again, you know, you have a bell-shaped curve of resistance in this situation and a violence that's from the occupied directed against the occupiers, against the settler state that violates human rights. That tail of resistance, like any statistician would tell you, you can condemn it, you can cut it off, the curve will renormalize. But the violent resistance from the occupation and from, in this case, from Israel directed against the Palestinian people has not been condemned. And I look for Israeli apologists and the Zionist movement in the U.S. to ever show me any incidents where they condemned human rights violations of the Israeli army, which are far, far more damaging to the Palestinian civilian population than the other way around. As I said, in all these situations, there are always civilians that are killed. The question is not condemning that. Of course, everybody condemns. I condemn it. Everybody condemns it. The question is what to do about it. In my book, I look forward to addressing, as we call it in the medical field, the etiology of a disease, not the symptoms of a disease. And the violence is simply a symptom of the disease, not the etiology or the underlying factor of the disease. If somebody has cancer, you know, they get symptoms like skin rash or headache, and you can give them aspirin, it can make them feel better. But unless you have chemotherapy and radiation therapy, you're not going to cure that. Mm.
This certainly is a conflict that has been going on for a long time. And from time to time, either there are periods that seem particularly bad, or there are times when people are optimistic and they say because of particular developments, they think, you know, perhaps there's a possibility of getting this thing resolved. At the time that Yasser Arafat died, people said, well, now here, this is an important possibility, chance to take a new beginning we go on from there. We have the leadership of the Israeli government, the prime minister, talking about withdrawal from Gaza. Some people think that that also is an important move. And yet, there doesn't really seem to be a lot of dramatic progress. And as much as people talk about the possibility of going forward and about there being peace, at the moment, it seems hard to find anything to grab onto that would make one feel particularly optimistic. Where do you think that things stand now?
Amnesty International articulated very well why peace processes failed. They said the reason Oslo Accords and other peace processes failed is because they ignore human rights. And so far, every peace process proposed by America and, of course, written by many in the Zionists in the U.S. administration have failed to address human rights. Human rights such as the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands. Unless you put human rights at the center of the peace process, you are going to have what I call pacification rather than simply a process, a durable peace process that leads to a durable and lasting peace. It will be pacification and it will be kind of a lull between the fighting, so to speak. And I think Amnesty is correct on that. Unless we put human rights and international law at the center of the equation, then we are going to always fall into the same trap of trying to pacify the native people rather than talking about real peace that's durable, that's equitable, that treats people equally, regardless of whether they are Jews, Christians, or Muslims who live in that land.
Do you think that it's significant, the decision, or at least the intention stated by Mr. Sharon to withdraw settlers from Gaza?
Well, Mr. Sharon's right-hand man, Dov Weisglass, explained about this quote-unquote disengagement from Gaza. They don't use the word withdrawal. They use the word disengagement. And Dov Weisglass argued that the reason for doing that is, in his words, to put the peace process in formaldehyde. In other words, to prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state that's viable, that's sovereign, that's independent, and keep prolonging. And indeed, that's what they got. They got from the U.S. a prolonging of the process, and they got from the Bush administration all sorts of promises about the refugees having no right to return to their homes and lands, about the settlements in the West Bank being retained, and so forth and so on. The reality of it, that's just, again, you know, just pacification rather than a peace process that's based on human rights and international law, which are very clear if you want to look at human rights and international law.
Hmm. Just one further question, and I have some callers here I want to get to. You touched on one of the things that I think in a lot of people's minds is an important and also very difficult issue, and that is the right of return. Is it that you're arguing and other Palestinians argue that when and if this new Palestinian state is established, that any Palestinian living anyplace else in the world should be able to go there and live there?
Well, international law and basic, like the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, are very clear about the right of refugees to return to their homes and lands. This is an inalienable right that's recognized by every international covenant, by every international organization, and also by UN General Assembly and United Nations Security Council resolutions. So refugees have a right to return to their homes and lands, Christian and Muslim refugees. Now, it doesn't make sense to say that any Jew and any convert to Judaism in the world can go live on Palestinian land and become an automatic citizen of the State of Israel, whereas a Palestinian who was born and raised there and their children cannot go back simply because they are not Jewish. They are either Christian or Muslim. That doesn't make sense. And I think that's where Human Rights and Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, every single human rights organization said you have to put that at the center of the equation.
Mm-hmm. Maybe let me again just ask if the calls will bear with me one further point. And as you write in the book that a lot of people would like to reduce this conflict to a matter of religion and say that essentially what we have here is Jews pitted against Muslims. Well, you're not a Muslim. You're a Christian. How do Palestinian Christians play into this? When, and I guess I'm interested in what your experience as a Palestinian Christian has been.
I mean, the Zionist program, starting with Ben-Gurion and Herzl, many of those folks were secular Jews who did not really believe in religion. Many of them actually despised religious Jews. It was never really a religious thing for them to start this program of removing Palestinians from their lands. 530 Palestinian villages were removed, ethnically cleansed, between 1947 to 1949. To them, it was never about religion. And many of these villages were Palestinian Christian villages, and they never distinguished between a Christian and a Muslim. As long as they are native Palestinians, they were in the way and had to be removed. And I think that's they didn't distinguish between us as Palestinian Christians and between Palestinian Muslims. They treated us equally. And of course, even they also treated many Jews with contempt, like Sephardic Jews and others who were oppressed and discriminated against in the early parts of the establishment of the State of Israel. So I think, you know, the idea that has to do with religion is just an idea that was developed post de facto to kind of justify continuing the process. As Osama bin Laden uses religion, there are many people who use religions. The Crusaders used religion, the conquistadores used religion, Christianity, and so on.
We have some callers. We'll get to them in just a moment. Let me introduce again our guest. We're talking with Mazen Kamsiya. He is a Palestinian-American political activist. He is involved or has been involved in a number of organizations. He's co-founder of the Palestinian Right to Return Coalition. He appears often in print, in op-eds, and also has been interviewed on broadcast outlets. He is trained as a scientist, was on the faculty of Yale Genetics, his area. He's also one of the founders of the Middle East Genetics Association. He's the author of a book, Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, and he is here visiting in the campus to talk. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. We have some callers, and we'll start with someone on the campus in line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just wanted to call in support of what you said earlier when you said that in Europe they get a different media coverage. And I often listen to one of the cable channels here, which broadcasts a network called Skola, which is newscasts from other countries. And a good example of what you're talking about is about 2 or 3 weeks ago, when those three, quote, teenagers, unquote, were shot playing in a field, apparently. In the United States, they just said three teenagers were shot, but on Skola, you could see actual footage of them being put into an ambulance, and at most, they were middle schoolers, so calling them teenagers is really a stretch, and two of them, at least, were headshot. No other marks on them, but their heads were bandaged and bloodied. So I really think what you said is absolutely correct, and it's really our media's fault. Thank you.
All right. Well, you want to comment on that at all?
There's a group in America called If Americans Knew. They have a website, ifamericansknew.org, which actually analyzes media coverage. Their last report, which was issued this week, actually, is about the New York Times coverage of children's death among Palestinians. And it turns out that the New York Times covered Israeli children's death at a rate of about 4-1 of Palestinian children's death in front page and headline coverage. And that's just the reality. I mean, this is statistical analysis they did of the New York Times coverage. And the New York Times, as many people know, is a liberal magazine. It's not even like a conservative or right-wing magazine. So I think, yes, in many ways, the U.S. public is being cheated. And there are radio stations like this one and many others that do a fairly decent job of presenting different perspectives. And I think people need to start looking for alternative media, including on the Internet, or as this gentleman said, in European media and other places.
All right, let's talk with someone else on our line number four. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
I'd like to ask Mr. Kamsiya about the 500 villages that they emptied in the early years of the occupation of Israel and Palestine. Are there people living in those villages?
Between 1947 and 1949, over a two-year period, about three-quarters of the Palestinians who lived in the area that became the State of Israel were removed from their land. Half of those refugees were created actually before May 1948, when the State of Israel was created and the Arab armies intervened, as you heard historically. The mythology was that the Arab armies came and told the refugees to leave. Well, as I said, the reality is that half the refugees have already been kicked out before the Arab armies intervened. Israeli historians now analyze the history of this process. As far as the villages now, most of these villages are empty. And Israelis even do not cultivate these lands because the kibbutz movement in Israel is bankrupt. Basically, Israel is now a heavily industrialized society, dependent mostly on military and other technological manufacturing skills. And so most of these villages' lands are still empty. Besides these 530 Palestinian villages that were removed, there were 200-plus additional villages that remained. And of those, 100 is considered by Israeli law to be unrecognized villages. They do not recognize them, even though they remain inside the State of Israel. And their citizens who still live there are Israeli citizens. They can vote, but they are unrecognized. They don't get municipal services. They don't get water. They don't get electricity. They don't get schools. That's just the reality of the remaining one quarter of the population that remained in Palestine, which became the State of Israel in 1949.
Does that get at your question, caller?
Yeah, then it kind of reverts back to maybe what would be good in that country would be a one-state solution with equal rights for everybody.
I mean, in my book, I was criticized by both Israelis and Palestinians in my book because I'm a post-nationalist. I do not believe in nationalism. I do not believe in these concepts of countries waving flags and putting borders to separate themselves from other countries. I think Europe is already illustrating that with dissolving its borders across the continent. And they realized that nationalism gave them both First World War and Second World War. So yes, in many ways, I do not argue that we need a Palestinian state or, in that sense, a Jewish state that's separate from a Palestinian state, but we need a state or changing, actually, not a state, but changing the concept of nationalism to a concept of citizenship, where citizens are treated equally regardless of their religions and have the same rights and the laws apply to all of them. So as I said earlier in the talk, in the conversation, that a Palestinian refugee can return to his homeland, should be able to return to his homeland, and is, you know, whereas you cannot say that they can't, while anybody who converts to Judaism or who's Jewish in America or anywhere else has automatic rights to citizenship in a state like the State of Israel and live on Palestinian land.
Thank you.
It seems pretty hard to believe, even if you could get a majority of Palestinians to agree to such an idea, that is really what amounts to a one-state solution as opposed to what we have always talked about as a two-state solution. It seems hard to believe you get a majority of Israelis to agree to the same thing, particularly if right of return was included, because their fear would be that if that happened, given demographics, the chances were pretty good that you'd end up with a state where Jews were actually, and Israelis were actually, a minority.
Yeah, we used to say the same thing in South Africa, that the majority of white South Africans would never agree to a one-state solution because the blacks would be a majority and there would be big problems. Of course, what ended up happening in South Africa is that the whites maintain economic control and economic superiority and actually are doing much better now under a removal of the apartheid regime than they did when the apartheid regime was in place and South Africa was subjected to sanctions and boycotts. And already we see the same parallels and the same trends developing with boycotts and divestments evolving against Israel and against Israeli companies and companies that invest in Israel. And I think eventually many Israeli Jews, like many white South Africans, realize that this is what what the trend is going to go, and they realized that that's what's going to happen. And it evolved peacefully without much bloodshed, as many had predicted, including me, by the way. I had thought that in South Africa those people will kill each other. But the reality is it did develop peacefully, and I hope and I trust and I truly believe that it can happen the same way with Palestine and Israel in the same situation. Not, I mean, if apartheid was a problem in South Africa, why would we think it's a solution, Israel-Palestine? Segregation didn't work here in the United States. It shouldn't be expected to work in Israel-Palestine.
Well, supposing just for a moment we stay with the idea of the two-state solution. The problem I think that a lot of Palestinians have with the proposals for a Palestinian state that has been made is that they make the argument that it's not a viable state. In your mind, supposing that we were going to do that, say even if we were going to argue that with some sort of intermediate stage, maybe we could move to the point where you would like to be, but in the meantime, say maybe we're going to do this. In your mind, what would constitute a viable state for Palestinians? What would it have to look like?
I think that's an excellent question, and I'm not against a two-state solution if the two states are based on human rights in both states, where the people are treated equally and where they have a viable condition, where they control their natural resources, they control their airspace, they are able to move freely within those states, they're able to move outside of those states as they like. The reality of it that that's Israel has never accepted that and will never accept it, and it will be very difficult to remove 450,000 settlers from the West Bank and Gaza, which is an area only 22% of Palestine. Even that 22%, which is marginally viable, how are you going to remove 450,000 settlers? And what's going to happen to the water resources? Israel now controls 80% of the water resources of the West Bank and Gaza, and they're not going to give that up. Even the left wing in Israel, like the Geneva Accords that people have talked about, left the water issue aside because they could not really figure out what to do with that. I'm a biologist, and I can tell you environmentally and biologically and the way sustainable environments develop, it would be very, very difficult to have two states that are sovereign and independent in this one contiguous territory called Palestine/Israel. So I think, and I discuss this in detail in my book in terms of sustainability and future development and economic things. And even for Israeli Jews, I think economically it would be very damaging to have a separate, independent Palestinian state. For Palestinians, it would be very damaging. It would not be in the best interest of people in the Middle East, regardless of whether they are Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, so-called Israeli Arabs, Palestinians living within the state of Israel, or Palestinians in the West Bank, or people who moved into areas like East Jerusalem who are Jewish.
We're a little bit past our midpoint. We have some other callers I will get to right in just a moment, but I do want to introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in here in the last little bit. We're talking with Dr. Mazen Kumsiya. He is a Palestinian-American political activist, has been involved with starting a lot of grassroots groups that have to do with the Mideast conflict, including Palestinian Right to Return Coalition, the Holy Land Conservation Foundation, Academics for Justice, and also the Middle East Genetics Association. He is, by his training, his academic training, a scientist with degrees from University of Connecticut and Texas Tech. He also did postdoctoral training at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital and the University of Tennessee. He appears frequently in the media in the U.S., the Middle East. If you'd like to read some of his ideas on the Middle East, you can look for a book that he's authored titled Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. It's published by Pluto Press and came out last year. There will, if you're here in and around Champaign-Urbana, where we are, you would have an opportunity, a couple of opportunities to hear him speak, and I do want to mention those. He will be talking this afternoon at 3 o'clock about the Palestinian right of return, and this would be at the Illini Union on the U of I campus. That's in room 407. And then he'll be talking also about the issues here, some of the same issues that we've been talking about at a talk at the University YMCA at Wright and Chalmers in Latzer Hall. That's also on the U of I campus, and that's tonight at 7:30. So those opportunities are there if you'd like to hear more from him. Questions here are welcome too. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. We have several callers here, starting out with line one and someone in Charleston. Hello.
Yes. If you'll allow me a bit of poetics first. I think it's the Protestant dogma about the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. In my opinion, the whole question of the Middle East will not be resolved until the U.S. abandons Israel. When the U.S. abandons Israel, it will fade away to nothing, just as it came from nothing in 1948, to the much the dismay of Palestine, which is an international crime which should not have happened, which these folk who had lived there for millennia and suddenly had superimposed upon their lives and upon themselves this outside influence orchestrated by the U.S. and England in the form of Israel. So that's my opinion, if I don't know what you think of that. But when the U.S. has no further use for the state of Israel, it will disappear. And now I'll hang up and listen.
Well, the official position of the United States has been for a long time. It certainly recognizes the right of Israel to exist and has supported Israel in various sorts of ways. Do you think that the fact that the United States government has long had that position, is that an impediment to solving the problem that we've been talking about? Or is that not that? Well, it doesn't really influence it one way or another.
I think people make a mixture between people and their governments. I certainly, do not want the U.S. to abandon Israel. I think the Israeli people, like any other people, deserve dignity and human rights like Palestinian people, like everybody else. And I think as far as the U.S. governmental support for Israel, for Israeli government, and including the human rights abuses that the Israeli government engages in, there has been a long tradition in the U.S. Congress of supporting Israel that goes back to the time of Truman when he decided to support the establishment of the State of Israel against the advisors that advised him otherwise and against many intellectual Jews, including Albert Einstein and Sigmund Freud and many others, who were against the proposition of establishing a political sovereignty that's called the State of Israel on Palestinian land. But that's a separate issue, and I don't want to spend too much time on it. But the reality of U.S. support for Israel is actually not an issue of support for the people of Israel, because 30% of Israeli children are living below the poverty line today, while Ariel Sharon is building a wall that's costing billions of dollars, and that's basically leaving Palestinians in ghettos of shrinking lands and creating the deferment for future instability and future violence that will affect everybody in the Middle East. So in my view, the U.S. government, if you ask me what is the role of the U.S. government is the biggest obstacle to peace in the Middle East. In fact, more an obstacle to peace in the Middle East than the Israeli government. There's a book by Noam Chomsky called The Fateful Triangle that talks about U.S. role in the Middle East. There's a book by Nasir Arouri that's titled Dishonest Broker that people could look up. There are many books on the U.S. role in the Middle East that explains why the U.S. is really against peace based on human rights and international law in the Middle East. The U.S. is not an honest broker, and the U.S. government has never been interested in peace in the Middle East, and there's plenty of evidence to support that.
Let's talk with some other callers. We have some here in Urbana. Next is line number two. Hello.
Hi. I have a question for Professor Comcia, which is, my belief is that there are some strong parallels between the occupation in Palestine and the occupation in Iraq. And not only are there strong parallels, but the two phenomena are very closely linked. Could you comment on that, Professor?
Yes, I mean the reason we went to Iraq, the real reason, not the reasons that the administration gave us about weapons of mass destruction, about terrorism, which are now known to be lies since there is no links between Saddam Hussein and between 9/11 or any of that stuff, as as they purported and as they publicized, and also the issue of weapons of mass destruction, which turned out to be a distraction and a lie. The real reasons that we went to Iraq is articulated very well by the architects of this war, people like Richard Perle, like Paul Wolfowitz, like Douglas Faith, like Cheney and others who wrote about these things in 1996, 97, 98, well before September 11. And they argued that parts of the reason is to control the faucet of oil, and it fits very well with our strategic interest with Israel and bringing Israeli interests and American interests closer together. They articulated this very well in documents like Projects for a New American Century, like the document that Richard Perle and company sent to Netanyahu, which is about strengthening Israel, basically. And that's, these people have articulated this. In fact, chillingly, in the Project for New American Century, these same folks said that it would be hard to sell the American public on the war, preemptive war like this to control these natural resources. And then they added, you know, it would take years to convince the American public. And then chillingly, they added, it might be easier, the words I use, save for a Pearl Harbor-like event. This is 1997, 98. In other words, if we get a Pearl Harbor-like event, it would be easier to convince the American public to support this preemptive kind of attack, hegemony of U.S. and Israeli interests in the Middle East.
Does that call? Does that get at your question?
Very well, thank you.
All right, let's go on to line three. This is also someone listening this morning in Urbana. Hello.
Yes, sir. What would be your opinion of a third city? I personally would like to be in a city with about 5,000-10,000 peaceful Israelis and 5,000-10,000 peaceful Palestinians. And if they would take that money and use it to try and build something, because you'd certainly get international attention. There are so many of us who would love to see a peaceful Palestinian-Israeli hybrid, if necessary, with an international protectorate, because it is a powder keg, and because I think it didn't it have something to do in the same cloth and yarn as the 9/11 event.
And I would urge you to write to your congressman and senator and say you guys are sending $3 to $6 billion every year to the state of Israel. We send to the state of Israel more money than what we send to South America, Central America, and Sub-Saharan Africa combined. I would suggest you write to your congressman and say, Congressman, you know, I know you have all this money to send since our schools are flush with money. And if you want to send $3 billion to Israel, why not dedicate at least a few millions of those $3 billion to build these cities, to have integration, to have joint schools instead of schools for Jewish children, schools for Palestinian children? Why not get some of that money to build joint schools, joint cities, joint projects, and see what they respond to you. See how that flies with our Congress, which is, you know, influenced by the Israeli lobby. I think it's important that the average American gets engaged and suggests ideas like that. I mean, the biggest thing about governments is they want you not to be engaged. They don't want you to be a citizen with opinion. They want you to be a consumer, just buy products. And if you are a citizen and if you engage, they think that you are treading on their territory, which you should just give them the right to do whatever they want to with your money and your taxes. So I agree with you in many ways.
Well, thank you.
Right. You think such a thing is possible, that you could get together a reasonably sized city or an area of territory with mixed Israeli-Palestinian population and have that be prosperous and everybody get along and do that as a demonstration project of what a one-state solution might look like?
Yes, why not? I mean, there are many Israelis. I mean, I can, on my website, which is just my last name, kumsiya.org, people can find lots of resources, lots of ideas. There's about 50 or 100 Israeli and Jewish groups that I list on my website that deal with human rights. There are many Palestinian groups that deal with human rights and that talk about the kinds of things that we do. We have an association now called Association for One Democratic State in Israel-Palestine. where it's headquartered in Geneva, actually. And I was just elected president of this association. And we are getting many Israelis to join, many Palestinians to join. We are working together. There are groups like the Israeli Committee Against Home Demolitions that includes Israelis and Palestinians that go prevent to stop home demolitions by the Israeli army. There are thousands of Israeli soldiers who are refusing to serve in the army. There are many people who are engaged on all sides, who are engaged genuinely in wanting peace and justice for that part of the world. I think we have to engage with all these people, and we have to get them involved in the process. And we have to put our money and our resources and our actions where our mouth is and not just say, well, they have to do something. What is it that we as American citizens have to do? Because it's our responsibility. It's our money. Every time Israel bombs a Palestinian refugee camp, they use American weapons with American money. So we've got to get involved. I mean, the bulldozer that killed Rachel Corey, an American student in Rafah, as she was trying to prevent the demolition of a Palestinian home, was a Caterpillar bulldozer made in America and paid for by our taxes. So it is our responsibility.
We have about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Just again, let me introduce our guest, Mazen Kamsia. He's Palestinian-American political activist. He appears frequently in the media in the U.S., the Middle East. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana. We'll give a couple of talks, one this afternoon, one tonight. And again, before we finish up here this hour, I'll mention the times and the locations. He's also author of the book Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle. It's published by the Pluto Press. I think that in the past there has been a lot of criticism of the Palestinian political leadership, some of that coming from Palestinians, who complained that it had been ineffective, corrupt, and also unable to, for those people who are interested in a nonviolent kind of solution, had been really unable to have much exercise, much control over those elements who were interested in using violence. How do you think that Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian current Palestinian president, has done on those three fronts?
Yeah, I mean, I criticized the Palestinian Authority actually on a TV station in Bethlehem in my last visit about a year and a half ago. I went there, and then actually my second to last visit, I went back again about a month and a half ago. But about a year and a half ago, I was on TV in Palestine, and I criticized the Palestinian Authority and Yasser Arafat. He was alive then. And I explained why I criticized him, because he is authoritarian. He was authoritarian. And that the movement has really abandoned the Palestinian cause by agreeing to a peace process that excludes human rights. And I think that was the biggest problem with the Palestinian Authority. And in a way, it reminded me of Chief Buthelezi in South Africa, who agreed also to solutions that involved the Africans in South Africa with the white minority that deal with just having a state, a flag, passports, but not really with solving the human rights violations that were rampant under apartheid. And Amnesty International, as I said that Oslo Accords violated human rights, and that's why they failed. And I think if people look at it from that way, I look at what Arafat did, and which is actually Mahmoud Abbas, since he was the one who was negotiating in Oslo, is they sold out the Palestinian cause. They sold out the cause of human rights. And in the process, they also harmed long-term interests of Israelis and Palestinians, not just Palestinians.
Yeah. I'm interested. You make this parallel between the Zulu leader Getachew Buthelezi in South Africa and Yasser Arafat. I think a lot of people in the pre-apartheid area were extremely critical of Buthelezi for being much too cooperative with the government. And I suppose that I would guess there would be people in the African National Congress who would have said that he was a traitor to the cause. You think that would you go as far as to say that about Yasser Arafat?
Well, I mean, Professor Edward Said of Columbia University wrote a book about the subject where he analyzed it far in detail. Oslo and Beyond, the book is called, and it discusses basically all the failings of Yasser Arafat and all his issues. And actually, his book was banned in the Palestinian Authority at one point. But that's the reality. Is Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas have decided that to go with the power to be, which is the U.S. government and Israel. and to play on the balance of power and say, well, if the U.S. and Israel are hegemonic, they control the situation, I have to play by their rules. I cannot resist them. Now, Arafat resisted at one point, which was at Camp David, after he basically gave up just about everything. The last step, he kind of balked at it. He was, in my opinion, essentially as on a probationary period, which expired for him. And the probationary period was whether he would be able to become like King Abdullah of Jordan, which is a puppet of the U.S., or Hosni Mubarak of Egypt. Those guys are puppets of the U.S., who U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East, which is hegemonic and in support of Israel. And if he was going to serve as those leaders, then he was going to stay in power. And if he wasn't, he was going to be isolated and shunned and maybe even killed. So that's just the reality of this. And people could read more about this in other books and literature. I could send people links about this.
Well, given the fact that the Palestinians do have these two major powers to contend with, the United States and Israel, is there an alternative? You were talking critically about Arafat and Mahmoud Abbas, saying, well, look, we do have these two hegemonic powers, and either we work with them or we got nothing. Is there actually an alternative if the Palestinians come along and say, well, we're really not going to work with the United States and with the government of Israel?
Right. Well, I mean, there's an issue of morality. And if you abandon your morality and you abandon human rights, then I don't know it's worth to have a Palestinian state. I don't want a Palestinian state that abandons morality and human rights. But even in a practical sense, I mean, yes, the U.S. and Israel are hegemonic and they have a lot of power. But things change, you know, powers change. And we look at history, the Roman Empire, we look at all these things change. And we look at the dynamics of the world situation now and we see it changing. I mean, when in the United Nations just a few weeks ago there was a vote, 156 countries voted in support of the Palestinian positions, and the U.S. and Israel voted against, I think joined by three great empires, the Marshall Islands, Micronesia, and Patau, three islands dependent on the U.S. So we already see there's an isolation of the U.S. and Israel position internationally. We see the Europeans standing up. We see revolutions changing the face of democracy in Venezuela, in Brazil, and other countries that are standing up to the United States' hegemonic power in the world. And we see the American public also, more importantly, the American public is standing up. Millions were on the streets against the war in Iraq and in support of Palestinian human rights. So I think things are changing and they will change. And I'm very optimistic that this country will change and Israel will change. I think I'm very optimistic. I'm very sure that this will happen within the next 5 to 10 years.
Hmm. We're coming down to the point, unfortunately, we have just a couple of minutes left. And one of the things we talked about earlier was one of the very difficult points. Again, going back, if we're assuming that we're going to do a two-state solution, one of the difficult points in the negotiations between the two sides was the right of return. Something else that we really haven't touched on, but I guess I'm interested in having you talk about for a minute or two, is Jerusalem and the future of the city. Again, a point where it seems that the two sides have positions that are just mutually exclusive. One with on the Israeli side insisting that Jerusalem will continue to be essentially controlled by Israel, and on the other side, at least in the past, it has been it's the mirror assertion from the Palestinian side that it ought to be a Palestinian, essentially a Palestinian administered city.
Right. I mean, I think Jerusalem would not be too difficult a problem to solve if we base it on human rights and the right of the people of Jerusalem to live in dignity and equality within the city. And it is one city. You cannot really say, well, it's this city and half a city here and half a city there. But you cannot also say Jerusalem must remain under Israeli sovereignty. You cannot also say that Jerusalem must be, quote-unquote, an Arab Islamic city. By the same token, Jerusalem is a shared city. It's holy to three faiths, and it has holy sites of three major religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. And there are ways to allow access, to allow freedom of movement, and to have the city not a sovereignty of a particular country. I mean, in fact, the United Nations Partition Resolution of 1947 said it would be an international city, and that's still is a valid recommendation. It's not a resolution that's implementable, but it's a valid recommendation of a General Assembly resolution. So there is ways to move around that issue. The question is whether there is the will. And as long as Israel gets billions of dollars of our money and support military and also by vetoes in the United States, in the United Nations, then obviously Israel has no incentive to compromise on this issue.
Well, I think that we are going to have to leave it at this point because we here have just used our time. And I want to say again that our guest this morning, Mazen Qumsiyya, a Palestinian-American political activist, is here. He's traveling around the country speaking about this issue and is spending some time here in Champaign-Urbana. And if you would like to hear more from him, he'll be talking on the Palestinian right of return at 3 o'clock this afternoon. This is at the Illini Union on the U of I campus on Green Street. And then also we'll be talking tonight on the subject Witness to Occupation, Witness for Peace, Deep Inside Iraq and Palestine. And this is a talk that takes place at the University YMCA on Wright, at Wright and Chalmers in Latzer Hall. This is also on the campus. That's tonight at 7:30. And if you're interested also, he is the author of the book Sharing the Land of Canaan, Human Rights and the Israeli-Palestinian Struggle, published by the Pluto Press. The book came out last year. And I do, want to mention that, you know, over time we have tried to present a number of perspectives on this issues from different people with different ideas, particularly when they were here and we had some access to them. And we're pleased to have Dr. Qumsiyya on the program, and we'll continue to do this when we get the opportunity. And if people have ideas on how they'd like us to be discussing this, we're certainly open to them. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. Today's broadcast is also made possible by a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Coming up a little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, Celeste Quinn will be talking with writer Tyree Jones. Imagine an accident that takes the life of your father and baby sister. The impact of that accident would remain with you forever. Tyree Jones' novel, The Untelling, is described as speaking of the circumstances that can either undermine or restore us, and the transformative power of examining all that we would keep untold. Tyree Jones is Assistant Professor of English at University of Illinois, and will be talking this afternoon with Celeste Quinn as part of the Afternoon Magazine. The program itself, with the usual mix of news and sports and weather and other things, gets underway at noon here on AM 580. Well, coming up in the next part of this program, Focus 580, we will spend some time talking about U.S. energy policy. Just last week, the House passed an energy bill. There's a lot of controversy about what it will or won't do. President Bush has been also talking about his feelings about energy policy, and we'll try to talk about some of these issues with James McKenzie. He is a senior associate at the World Resources Institute. That'll be in the next part of the show, so we hope you'll stick around. We'll have news from National Public Radio first, though, an update on the markets.
And with this update on the markets at 10:58 and a half, I'm Jay Pierce. Good morning. Well, Board of Trade soybeans have turned lower on speculative selling after a firm opening following the first 2005 discovery of Asian soybean rust on soybean plants outside of Florida, and a stronger than expected U.S. March soybean crush figure, according to brokers. We'll take a look at how the soybean numbers are going in just a moment. First,